From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the eyes of the world, Iraq is Saddam Hussein's domain. But in Iraq's fertile heartland, settlers under Gilgamesh created irrigation systems, and ancient Babylonians drafted the world's first recorded legal code. Great waves of time and people and learning have swept this land. Author Joseph Browdy looks to Iraq's resilient history as the hope and foundation of a new, pluralistic, post-Saddam powerhouse in the Middle East. Tonight on Point, an intimate look at the country beneath Saddam Hussein. We begin with the brewing humanitarian challenge in Iraq. Today, a British cargo ship carrying more than 650 metric tons of emergency supplies, food, water, and medicine, docked in the southern port city of Umm Qasr. But its cargo only begins to address mounting civilian needs. Rick Augsburger is director of emergency response programs at Church World Service, a global humanitarian aid organization. I asked him to sketch out what's arrived and what may be required.
The volume on that ship is really just the tip of the iceberg. In Iraq, it's estimated that it will take at least 480,000 metric tons to provide for the food needs in the country since the beginning of conflict. And that's per month. That's 480,000 metric tons per month.
How many shiploads or truckloads does that represent, very roughly?
That would be difficult to estimate. It would depend on the commodity, oil, wheat, rice, etc.
But a lot more than one cargo ship.
Absolutely.
And today also we saw the Security Council voting to resume the oil for food program. Do you have an understanding of how that will roll out? How will it physically, logistically resume?
The developments today at the United Nations, which give the Secretary General Kofi Annan control over the oil for food pipeline for at least the next 45 days, we see as a very positive development. However, the concern still remains, Tom, that how quickly will we be able to see that food distributed in Iraq? The Oil for Food program had 46,000 distribution points throughout the country. And obviously now transportation and movement throughout Iraq is quite difficult. So even though the Oil for Food program has been put under the oversight of the General Secretary, which is very positive, the actual distribution of that food will still be a tremendous challenge during the conflict.
Can you imagine a network of trucks moving across Iraq to 46,000 distribution centers during wartime?
That would be extremely difficult and quite dangerous. The only way that could happen would be if there was a very concerted effort on part of the coalition forces to create access and to allow for humanitarian space which is safe and secure so that that distribution could take place.
You know, of course, there was wide expectation of very rapid progress and control of southern cities, that the food would begin flowing into those cities right away. U.S. officials have expressed frustration that that is not happening. Is the development this week of the longer time horizon for this conflict changing expectations around relief and changing the humanitarian problem?
Tom, I would say that it is. I mean, one of the other kind of tangential issues that you have there is that not only is the access a problem right now in terms of timing, but we also have the very serious issue of the appropriateness of coalition forces or military forces participating in the distribution of the assistance. That in itself creates a number of problems in terms of the impartiality of the assistance provided, the message that comes with that assistance. And so it's not only an issue of access and timing, but it's also an issue as how this humanitarian assistance will be delivered.
That's an interesting point you bring up. Are you saying that Church World Service would resist military distribution of food to people who are hungry?
We believe very strongly that the only time the military should be involved in the delivery of humanitarian assistance is when it is the only option available.
But the U.S. military and British are having enough time already just sorting out Iraqi civilians and combatants. Do they really want to see trucks full of non-governmental organizations, NGOs, roaming around in the midst of that fight?
Well, I would hope, Tom, that if one of the primary objectives here is to care for the people of Iraq, and we've heard that over and over, that yes, there would be some concerted effort to allow for the humanitarian organizations to do what they do best.
Rick Augsburger, what's at stake here in terms of the potential problem? How badly might this go if some system is not set up for getting food and water over much of this country? As you said, 60%, that's nearly 14, 15 million people are dependent on or have been dependent on that UN Oil for Food program. What might happen if something isn't resumed fairly soon?
If the distribution of food does not resume in the next few weeks, we could see a very, very difficult humanitarian crisis. Obviously, when you have 60% of the population reliant on food aid in order to survive, once that food aid is cut off, you will see things deteriorate very quickly. And the food aid has been cut off at this point. So if it is not reestablished within the next few weeks, we will see one of the most difficult humanitarian food aid crises that we've seen in a single country that is experiencing conflict. Now, the other thing that I should mention, when the food aid distribution begins, it's important that it can maintain a continuous effort and that the food can be available to the families on a regular basis. We've heard today that World Food Program, along with the non-governmental organizations that will be assisting in the provision of food, are planning the largest program that they've ever undertaken to be able to provide food assistance to the people of Iraq.
Rick Augsburger, your organization, Church World Service, opposed this war in the first place. Now it's fairly widely understood that Iraq hopes to make a humanitarian crisis part of its defense against the U.S. forces there. Are you concerned about being pulled in an integral way to the politics of this conflict?
Tom, we've made it very clear that we will not provide humanitarian assistance under the direction of any military force. It's very important to us as an organization to maintain our independence and to be able to deliver impartial humanitarian aid. So although that concern is there, Tom, I think it's there for the entire humanitarian community. We are standing very firm that Church World Service will provide aid based on need, based on vulnerability, and will not be part of a political or military agenda.
You may not be able to avoid getting embroiled in that.
Tom, we hope that we will be able to, and we will do everything that we can to stay out of any type of situation that compromises our belief as a relief and development organization.
Rick Augsburger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Rick Augsburger is Director of Emergency Response Programs at Church World Service, a global humanitarian aid organization. He spoke with us earlier from New York. Iraqi legend has it that the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, which flow through its center, also flowed through the Garden of Eden. Paradise has fallen on hard times under Saddam Hussein after two major wars and a dozen years of sanctions. The country's infrastructure is in shambles. Ethnic and religious frictions simmer. Middle and professional classes have been decimated, and the entire population deeply scarred by intimidation and brutality. Through it all, author Joseph Browdy sees the distinct makings of a vibrant, reborn society. Much may soon ride on whether or not he is right. Can you see Iraq emerging as the world's next new great society, a powerhouse of hot markets, democracy, and shining civilization? You've heard of the Tigris and Euphrates, but what do you truly know of Iraq? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Joseph Browdy, senior analyst at Pyramid Research and author of the new book, The New Iraq. Good evening and welcome, Joseph Browdy.
Good evening, Tom.
Thank you so much for being with us. There's so much to dig into here, and reading your book, Joseph Browdy, made me realize the many great areas of pure mystery in my mind about Iraq, and you've helped clear a bunch of those up. But I wish you'd start right off the top by painting a picture, and you're good at that, I can see from this book, painting a picture of, first, the view of Iraq as you perceive it among most people, most Americans these days, the sort of common picture of what Iraq is, and put up against that your picture of what Iraq is and can be.
Well, it seems to me that Americans know mostly about Iraq through our media, and our media tells us mostly about Saddam Hussein and his supporters. So I think that images of military fidayeen troops and indeed the man with the mustache are most of what Americans know about Iraq, alas.
What's missing? We're going to look at a lot of detail tonight, but in broad stroke, what is the Iraq that you would like people to perceive, to understand?
Well, I wrote my book to try to persuade people that Iraq is a very rich and complex society that has indeed persisted under Saddam's vast shadow and manifested remarkable resiliences from a distant past.
We're going to look at some of that. The timing of the book is very interesting. You almost got it spot on. As I read this book, though, it seems to me that a fundamental presumption is that by the time the reader picks it up and reads it, Saddam will be gone. He's not.
I had hoped, as the crisis was emerging, that more countries would follow in the footsteps of the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Kuwait in calling on Saddam to step down. I think we really don't know what the world would be like today if organizations, individuals, and countries had united behind that rallying cry.
Well, but you're still presuming throughout the book that he will be gone, and you've seen the war open up. You're willing to stand on that presumption?
Yes. The basic premise of the book is that Saddam will be out of power sometime by the end of this year.
All right. I want to dive into to some of the attributes or expectations that are embedded in your book, Joseph Prouty, and they are exuberant in their enthusiasm for this battered country. You're talking about an Iraqi economy that will not only be revived, but will invigorate intellectual activity throughout the Arab world, an economy altering the region's business ecosystem, building a new industrial base, reviving a new commercial base of historical importance for the whole region, creating a space for Iraq. This is a post-Saddam Iraq, creating a space for the emergence of religious ecumenism, promoting ideals of coexistence and tolerance, of a military transform, providing a model that strengthens security in the region, reduces bloated military budgets, of great new investment in education and health and industry right across the region, of rising expectations right across the region from the model of this Iraq to come, of better governments. That is an enormous palette of expectations from a country that we've come to associate with dictatorship, with war, with trouble.
Well, one word missing from that excerpt you just read is democracy. And I think those who read the book find that, although enthusiastic, and I appreciate your noticing that, I am optimistic about the future of Iraq. The expectations are not realist, not over exuberant. For example, when I say that Iraq, a revitalized Iraqi economy can serve to revitalize intellectual activity throughout the Arab world, it's because Iraq has historically been a vital consumer market for books. There's an expression in the Arab Middle East that books are written in Cairo, published in Beirut, and read in Baghdad. And that is a socioeconomic reality. So imagine the impact of a decimated Iraqi economy under the era of sanctions. It need not be long before sanctions are lifted and oil begins to pump and export freely again. And the notion of a vast consumer market for books in Baghdad is entirely expectable.
So the intellectual link there is, you're saying, a free, democratic Iraq, a revived economy, a resumption of its historical place as a kind of center of learning, and suddenly a fountain, a gusher of new works and academic treatise and thinking coming out of Baghdad to the Arab world, to the whole world.
Well, once again, as I said a moment ago, democratic Iraq are your words, not mine. I do value democracy and believe that that is what Americans should promote, and clearly that is the direction that a state-building project will take. But I use words like a pluralism of voices, notions of fostering representative government and social economic justice in a country where wealth has historically been hoarded, as well as political power and educational opportunity, by a small clique in the center of the country. So no, my book does not say that Iraq will become a democracy overnight. On the contrary, the last words of the book, among them, are transition happens overnight, transformation takes time.
And you're talking about centuries, practically, when you raise time there.
Well,
or at least a very long time horizon you appear to be open to.
Well, I don't quite follow the question. I do believe that aspects of the exuberant ambitions to which some aspire are a multi-generational project, but there are realistic goals that can be set and met in the next few years.
We're going to come back in just a few minutes. We're talking with Joseph Rowdy. He's author of the new book, The New Iraq. We're looking at taking an intimate look at that Iraq tonight, at the country beneath the man, Saddam Hussein. Here's your chance. What don't you know that you want to know about Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're taking an intimate look tonight at Iraq, at the country beneath the man, Saddam Hussein, with Joseph Browdy. He's author of the new book, The New Iraq. Can you see Iraq as the world's great next new society, a powerhouse of hot markets and civilization, economic activity? Given what's exploded on our television screens in the last week, are you ready to anticipate, to understand, to embrace Iraq as a new regional beacon of hope post-Saddam? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joseph Browdy, you've got a deep family connection in Iraq. As I understand from the book, your grandfather, great-grandfather, was chief rabbi in Baghdad. That must have been quite a position.
It was, in a city where 40% of the population was Jewish, a community that indeed goes back in the lands of Iraq 2,700 years.
Talk to us about Iraqi history. We want a real short course from you tonight, and we're just going to go right across the waterfront. You take us into issues of the military, of money, but history is very important in a country with so much of it. Give us what we need to know in a nutshell, because that's all we've got, about Iraq's past, what most breathes today in the minds of Iraqis.
And what you just said is just the issue. It's not history as such, but memory. How Iraqis remember their past. What is it about their past that they also select out? Indeed, that's our memories is what informs our worldview and the way we perceive the people around us and the projects we take on. I think that Iraqis remember a past which is a glorious civilization, indeed the cradle of civilization, the bridges and tunnels that we drive past, along and through, our ideas about the oneness of God, and the notion of the rule of law are all inventions of some of the most dynamic empires and states of the world, all of which were in the lands of modern Iraq.
We've got these kind of buzz phrases from the American elementary school textbook, the Tigris and Euphrates, the Fertile Crescent, Babylon, Mesopotamia. Give us a quick string through that. This was one of the world's, or perhaps the world's, first center of civilization, as we understand it. It's seen lots of empires since then, pre-Islam, post-Islam. Which of those are most influential in the thinking of Iraqis today?
Well, clearly, ancient memories resonate with Iraqis, but I would venture to say that in a country presently some 96 or 97% Muslim, it's the Islamic period that has the most impact on the way people relate to one another in contemporary Iraq. Sectarian divisions between Sunnis and Shia, indeed, these sectarian divisions are the political divisions of yesterday in an emerging Islamic polity that was articulated in Baghdad.
We've seen just in the last few days cities like Najaf and Karbala at the center of U.S. troops' progress through Iraq. These very important in the history of Shia Islam. Give us just a brief explanation of the birth of that branch and the significance of that split. I think many Americans look at Sunni and Shia and don't quite get it. Lay that out for us. Iraq is the birthplace of that fork in the road.
Yes, Najaf and Karbala, the cities you mentioned, are two of the holiest cities to Shiis. Najaf is a city of graves, among other things, something like the Mount of Olives to Jews in Jerusalem. Najaf is the place where Shiis, who espouse a millenarian worldview, go to be buried when they can.
Wherever they live, from all over the world.
From all over the world. And in fact, there are many people who are temporarily interred in bordering countries of Iraq, awaiting reburial in Najaf once the borders open up again. Karbala, which is perhaps the holiest city to Shiis outside of Mecca and Medina, is the scene of the martyrdom of Hussein, who is so important in Shi'i collective memory. When you see a Shi'i individual praying today, anywhere in the world, he puts down a stone that his forehead will make contact with when he's prostrate and on the ground, and that is traditionally a stone from the city of Karbala.
You talk about the history of learning in Baghdad, City of Peace. It's an ancient kind of a trademark. I don't know if it still has that moniker today, but about a great trading center, but also a great center of learning where mathematics and medical techniques advances in understanding of climate and banking and letters of credit and exchange, massive private libraries and bookstores. Update that for us. What did that mean in the modern period for Baghdad compared to Western countries, compared to other Arab countries or countries in the region about its level of literacy, its interaction with the world, its commercial sophistication before the troubles of Saddam Hussein hit it like a ton of bricks? What did we see? Did we see a modern manifestation of those ancient roots?
Well, I dare say that the transition to nationalism from Iraq not having a political identity of its own was a turbulent one for the country. Iraq is formed out of three former provinces of the Ottoman Empire and indeed is a contrivance of the British who arranged by mandate to rule those lands for a period after the First World War. That having been said, I actually give credit to nationalist period in Iraq for raising literacy rates enormously. Indeed, the Ba'ath Party itself initiated the comprehensive campaign for the compulsory eradication of illiteracy. Hmm. That's what it was called. And according to their own estimates, they managed to raise literacy rates to 87% in the 80s.
But what is it about Iraq's path that makes you so optimistic about its economic future? Apart from, I mean, we all acknowledge the oil wealth. It's there and it's gigantic. But you really go beyond that to say this can be, should be, a real commercial center. And beyond that, a real center of thought in the Arab world, in the world at large. Why Iraq?
Well, you referred just now to commercial center and thought. Regarding commercialism, one need only look back a few decades to remember an Iraq that was not only a major oil exporter, but perhaps more significantly, a major manufacturer. It was so sad to hear the gentleman you were talking to earlier talk about humanitarian aid, considering that Iraq was fairly recently an exporter of foodstuffs to the region around it and to the world at large. In recent years, we've seen Iraq transform from an exporter to a net importer of foods.
But you're really talking about more than just vibrant agriculture. You're talking about it being an economic leader.
That's right.
I have acquaintances who've done business there and said to me before all this trouble started, you know, this is a country that really has done business in a very vigorous way with the West. It maybe has the most potential of any Arab country to be a player in the global economy.
It has indeed. It had a very strong manufacturing base, which was unfortunately fell dormant in recent years. Some 85% of the factories that were operating on the eve of the 1990-91 war are now asleep. So manufacturing was there. Iraq was a major investor in its own infrastructure and in countries around it. Iraq was exporting textbooks as recently as the Ba'ath period to countries from Mauritania to Djibouti, textbooks that were the standard of instruction in Arabic, as well as major contributions to history, sociology, and other intellectual activities. That's up to the very recent past.
So when you say, I'm not so worried about how to stem American cultural imperialism in Iraq. Instead, I'm trying to figure out how to foment Iraqi cultural imperialism in the Middle East and beyond. What do you mean, Joseph Prouty?
That's the end of a chapter on the Iraqi entertainment industry. We all know about the outstanding contribution Iranian cinema has made to the world in recent years. And you don't have to go that far back to remember great movies coming out of Iraq. One of my personal favorites was a movie called Al-Amira wa Nahar, The Princess and the River, a two-hour-long animated feature film, an Iraqi yellow submarine set in the ancient world of Akkadian myth. There is a lot of creativity in the country right now, although it's not possible for Iraqis to make much film these days because of the poverty and also because, among other things, the chemicals necessary for the production of film have been regarded as dual-use technology in the sanctions regime. Many of the would-be actors and producers are now in neighborhood theaters performing burlesque shows, including some gentle political satire that even takes digs at the regime from time to time.
Here's an expectation, a longing for a shining Iraqi future. Can you feel it? Can you see it? Do you anticipate it? We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Joseph Browdy, author of the new book, The New Iraq. James is calling from Shrewsbury, Vermont. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
I would like Joseph Browdy to give his views on how democracy is going to fit with the Islamic values of a society like Iraq.
And we should, I should say that though I've raised democracy several times, Joseph Browdy pushes back and talks about pluralism. But I think the question stands, James and Joseph Browdy, given that President Bush has made democracy or freedom and the implication of democracy key words. Joseph Browdy, describe Iraq's political culture. How much pluralism, how much decentralized power, how much democracy can it, might it ultimately sustain?
James's question is an outstanding one, and in fact, in my chapter on religious leadership in Iraq today, I try to tell the story of how complex, indeed, the clerical scene is in Iraq. I think that as we get to know it a little better, we'll discover that it may defy easy labels like Islamic fundamentalist, moderate extremist, and so on. Indeed, one of the few indigenous non-government networks of charity and philanthropy is the Shi'i Khums Tax, which goes back a long way and persists as a conduit of funds that enables people to contribute and pay for the less advantaged in their own country. That having been said, there's surely concern that that some notion of fundamentalism or extremism could be fomented. Part of that, as we've learned from examples elsewhere, is the inflow of ideological capital from petro funds in neighboring Saudi Arabia and Iran. There might be ways to stem that, and further, there might be ways to foster cultures of humanism and tolerance, which indeed exist. One of the great sociologists of the Arab world is Iraq's own Ali al-Wardi, who sees religion through the filter of humanism and rejects the essentializing of Islam and the monopolization of Islam by one political group to the exclusion of another.
But given Iraq's recent history and given this expectation or fear that that an Islamist regime or future may be out there for it as one way of solving internal contradictions there, can you see something potentially emerging here in a year, in 5 years, in 10, that Americans might recognize as at least pluralistic, if not fully democratic?
Yes, I can. And another lesson that we learned from looking at extremist and fundamentalist movements across the globe is that extremism is often one part chauvinism and two parts social disaffection. Countries where an enormous impoverished underclass are excluded from economic opportunity are the ones that are the breeding grounds in many cases for extremist movements. So the extent to which we will achieve a victory over extremism in Iraq or anywhere else is largely in proportion to the extent to which social and economic justice is achieved. I think it's an intuitive point. The challenge is how to do it and indeed, what role we should play in that project.
What's your thought on that? Because that challenge may be right in front of us. How on earth do you deal with a country that's been ruled by Saddam Hussein and his crew for so long and so brutally, as you describe? How do you get from where Iraq is now to that more just distribution, to expectations of the rule of law, to something pluralistic or even democratic?
Well, it begins with a type of a, I may say, radical reorientation of economic policy in Iraq. It's clear enough that in the short term, a military government will be in place, assuming that the war ends. And it will be in American and Iraqi hands before it is turned over to a provisional government. So I hope that the United States will work to reinvest oil revenue into the human and physical infrastructure of the country. My book goes into some detail on what sectors and what aspects of human infrastructure indeed require the most capital at this point.
So you're saying by investing, by building up an economic base, you can create a seedbed for pluralism? Why not a strongman? The image of a strongman has been there a long time. The United States might well want to lean on that. Do you think we can avoid some more benevolent version of Saddam Hussein?
Well, that is the concern, I think, that a lot of Iraqis share, who are hopeful that the U.S. will make good on its pledge to promote provision representative government in Iraq. You're right that a lot of Iraqis, including those who oppose Saddam, believe that Iraq needs a strong man to hold it together. And I hope that's not the case. I think that the way to avoid it is to some extent to decentralize and reduce the stakes by distributing the wealth and distributing the power across the three regions of the country, so that Iraq will move toward a sort of a confederation.
This is the Sunni, Shia, and Kurd regions, you mean?
Well, we could say that, or you could think in terms of Baghdad, Basra, and Mosul.
Mm-hmm. They're central,
not
south, north.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're not homogeneous, any of these regions, although you're right that there is ethnic dominance and religious dominance in different places.
Joseph Prati, it sounds like such a long shot. Are you optimistic or are you longing?
Yes. Well, the longing is certainly there, and perhaps you've detected a little bit of irony in my book. I am optimistic, but I realize that this was truly an audacious and risky venture. The stakes are higher because we've engaged Iraq militarily, and it is a risk, and that's why my book makes the case for an engagement of societies, for an involvement not only of American and other Western diplomats and soldiers in this emerging project of state building, but also bringing in professionals, artists, social entrepreneurs, and many others to engage their Iraqi counterparts.
You mean from outside? You mean from America?
I think that there is an important role to be played by outsiders. I say that not with any condescension toward the people inside the country, simply that a country that has been artificially isolated, whose people flow has been blocked as brutally as its information flow, not only by international sanctions, but also by its own government, may need a bit of help in order to reintegrate into the world around it.
Here's a shining vision. We're taking an intimate look at Iraq tonight, the country beneath the man, Saddam Hussein, with Joseph Browdy, author of The New Iraq. You can join us as Joseph Browdy's enthusiasm for Iraq fire you up for regime change. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're taking an intimate look at Iraq tonight, at the country beneath the man, Saddam Hussein, perhaps the country that lies ahead. My guest tonight is Joseph Browdy, author of The New Iraq. Can you see Iraq as the world's next great new society, a powerhouse of hot markets, democracy, and civilization, or at least a pluralistic society? Can Iraqis escape the imprint and scars of Saddam Hussein? And are you ready to put Iraq stocks in your portfolio? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ali is calling from Boston. Hi, Ali. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to bring up a point with your guest, Joseph, and that is I think he's a little bit to be honest with you, I think he's a little bit out of touch with the reality of the state at this time in Iraq. I think the damage that Saddam has caused his people and the society is going too deep down for intellectuals to be able to communicate with the regular street people. And I'm talking out of experience with Iran, and I have a very bad feeling that if this thing is not handled immediately through a provisional government and a strong man, a military man, a U.S. man, whatever you want to call it, that's taking control at first of the country, the transition has to be swift and quick before the Islamists can take roots in the country. And something like Iran could come up, or Algeria. That is, just by default, the government can force the society into a civil war of the militant Islamists and the U.S. Friendly government.
Ali, I'll put all that to Joseph Brody, but let me ask you first: what do you mean in your comment of you doubt that returning Iraqi intellectuals will be able to join hands with the common Iraqi in the street after Saddam's years?
Well, I'll give you an example. I'm from Iran originally, and during the revolution, and actually what happened with the revolution, the intellectuals used Islam to bring down Shah, and they thought that they have the control of the whole situation. But where they were wrong is that the mullahs at the time could speak the language of the people in the street, and they had a very vast network with their own constituency.
We've got it. And so what the intellectuals dreamed of was in a way hijacked. Ali, thanks for your call. We're losing your phone there, but let me turn to Joseph Brody. Joseph, you hear the question here, first of all. Is there a bridgeable gap between the people you'd like to see flowing back into Iraq and the population that's been so put upon and damaged there during the Saddam Hussein years? And can the militant Islamic path be avoided?
Ali is right to point out that there are enormous risks, and the bridging of those two sides that he described, the people on the inside and intellectuals, be they inside or outside, is one that will be difficult to bridge. It's really nice to hear from someone from Iran. I had the privilege to live there in 1998. I think, in fairness, one should compare the climate on the eve of the Iranian Revolution to the situation in Iraq today. Iran was primed for revolution because, like other countries that go toward revolution, it had a middle class that had tasted something but wanted more. There was a clerical structure that was very strong, that indeed had its roots several centuries going back in the Safavid Empire, and had not only not been made war against by the Pahlavi government, but had actually in some ways been fostered as a counterweight against the Marxists. By contrast, in Iraq today, Saddam has systematically waged war against any political manifestations at all. And there are strident Iraqi Islamist groups. There are traces of Iraqi Muslim Brotherhood everywhere from Saudi Arabia to the United States. And, of course, we have the movement of Baqar al-Hakim sitting in Iran. But there's little evidence that these groups have strong sway in the country today.
So you're saying that Saddam's kind of scorched earth policy politically, no opposition of any kind, means that the militant Islam may not have the same foothold here. But how quickly could it grow? Could it grow more quickly than whatever government follows Saddam Hussein?
Well, that's just what you said, that because returnees who harbor these views and ideas about the way government should be will need to build up these networks from scratch. And in some ways, they'll be doing the same thing that the American initiative will do. It will be a competition in the marketplace of ideas.
To the race will be on. Joan is calling from Soldiers Grove, Wisconsin. Hi, Joan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm curious, and I liked Mr. Browdy's assessment on this. Given the Iraqi people that he's described, how was it in the first place that he believes that Saddam Hussein was even able to get into power and stay so long and so completely?
That a people with such a lustrous, learned past and so much opportunity, it's a great question, Joan. Joseph Browdy?
Well, I think that there are several factors, and there's no question that a brutality streak exists in Iraqi society. It's been described in great scholarship by Shafiq Ghabra in Kuwait, who's now the head of the American University over there. And the notion of putting down a population by fear is one that that is strong, and we've seen it in other countries of the world, not just Iraq. There's also an idea that, to some extent, Saddam is the heir to a perpetuation of the bloody minority rule in Iraq and the disenfranchisement of other groups. So it's natural that the only way a minority culture can hold a disaffected majority in check is through brutality.
So are we going to see that all over again?
Well, that is a fundamental conundrum that the United States will find itself in. To what extent does America want to commit itself to a radical re-engineering of the structure of power? I say this because it doesn't really matter how many Shiites you suddenly put in the leadership of the country if the vast majority of Shiites remain an undereducated, impoverished underclass. Will the U.S. seek, indeed, to alter the fundamental rules of the game and change a kind of a social and economic reality that has been the same since the days of the British Empire?
We've just got a minute left, Joseph Brody, but on that point, let me ask you about the Ba'ath Party, Saddam Hussein's party. You write that it was organized on the same kind of cellular organization of revolutionary Bolshevism, very resistant to being dug out and done away with. Is this going to continue to be a contender, even if Saddam Hussein is pushed out, even if a great American army is there? Might his party continue to struggle even underground for power?
Yes. In a word, although the Ba'ath may be banned and there may be campaigns to reduce its influence, there's no doubt that the technocrats and bureaucrats who have held the country together for these long, hard years have an essential role to play in the future of the country, and newcomers to the scene will need to engage many of them constructively, hopefully not the most brutal among them.
Joseph Brody, in spite of all that, you give us an enthusiastic and optimistic picture. We'll keep reading. We'll keep hoping. We appreciate the dream, and we appreciate you being with us tonight. Joseph Brody is author of The New Iraq. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, for continuing coverage of the war in Iraq, go to our website, onpointradio.org. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
However long it takes to achieve our objective, and that's important for you to know, the American people to know, our allies to know, and the Iraqi people to know. However long it takes. That's the answer to your question, and that's what you got to know.
There is a massive amount that has already been achieved. I mean, after all, coalition forces are within 50 miles of Baghdad. The southern oil fields are secured. The west is protected from external aggression. We've got forces going into the north. Now, we will carry on until the job is done.
I stand by this plan. I think General Franks put together a good plan. I'll give you a definitive statement. I think it's a brilliant plan. There's branches and sequels to everything that might possibly happen. But the plan is sound, it's being executed, and it's on track.
We have information that shipments of military supplies have been crossing the border from Syria into Iraq, including night vision goggles. These deliveries pose a direct threat to the lives of coalition forces. We consider such trafficking as hostile acts and will hold the Syrian government accountable for such shipments.
Humanitarian coordinator for Iraq expressed his deepest concern today at reports that there had been an airstrike on a market in Baghdad this morning, which resulted in heavy casualties.
The United Nations Security Council has just moments ago voted unanimously to reauthorize the Oil for Food program. The president would like to express his thanks to the United Nations Security Council for this unanimous action. This will be a way to help take care of the humanitarian needs of the Iraqi people using Iraqi resources.
We have lost a great American, an extraordinary senator, an intellectual, and a man of passion and understanding about what really makes this country great.
And there is a remarkable week. A testy President Bush tells a reporter the war in Iraq will go on for as long as it takes. Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair at Camp David says American and British troops have made significant progress in the first week of war. General Richard Myers responds to criticism that the American war plan may have underestimated Iraqi resistance. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld issues a stern warning today to Syria. An explosion in the Al-Shab market in suburban Baghdad kills at least 17 civilians. Another explosion rocked a market in the city today with more than 50 deaths reported. White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer hails today's UN decision to resume Iraq's oil for food program. And Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton remembers one of America's political giants, four-term New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who died Wednesday at age 76. Jack Beatty, we are at war.
We're at war, and, you know, I'm trying to step back from it just for a minute to sort of say, ask ourselves, what's historic here? What's unique? Because I think one of the problems I'm at least having is kind of fitting my mind around the contours of what's been happening these past months, because there doesn't seem to be any guide for them in the past. Well, let's just start with the obvious. This is the first unprovoked war of aggression in U.S. history. And it affects everything here, I think. I think it affects the way we're seen internationally. I think it affects certainly the way we're seen in the region. It's a new step, and it's not the end. I mean, we know there's this preemptive policy that says we will make war on the basis of what might happen. And that means North Korea and Iran and possibly Syria are next on this list. Secondly, the war is being fought by a Secretary of Defense who has contempt for the judgment of the professional military. That is clear. That's been asserted even now on television. This is an extraordinary thing. The civilian manager of the armed forces does not trust and does not essentially listen to his military subordinates.
He may be listening closer after this week with the tens of thousands of more troops now on the way to Iraq.
Yes, it seems he is. But right out asserted today in the Financial Times, quoting someone in the Pentagon, he has contempt for the judgment of the professional military. Three, we're going into a war without our old structure of international opinion with us, our alliances. Compare 1991, when we were fighting a justified war, wholly justified, backed by the UN, all our allies with Arab allies. So I think that these historic elements, we live in an entirely new time when you can say things like this about a U.S. action.
And Americans pondering all that and at the same time feeling a full fellow feeling with those troops in the field who are taking real fire and showing real courage in facing it. A remarkable week, as you say, Jack, in many dimensions, an historic week.
Yeah, and that's the part of it that isn't historic, the American fighting man and woman, the devotion of ordinary Americans to their country, and this is always moving, and it's what makes the country strong.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help this week from Micheline Boudreau and Darren Manoogian. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.